You're listening to the Addiction Medicine Podcast, the official podcast of the Governor's Institute. If this is your first time listening, thanks for joining us. The Addiction Medicine Podcast is designed for healthcare professionals and others interested in addiction medicine and will feature thoughtful conversations and insights from clinicians, patients, and families, policymakers, and other stakeholders. Remember to make us a favorite wherever you get your podcasts. You can also stay connected with us at governorsinstitute.org or follow any of our social media channels at GovInst.
In this episode of our three-part series on recent changes to the rules around who can prescribe buprenorphine, we're going to ask and answer questions that providers and pharmacists may have about the changes. We're grateful to have Dr. Blake Fagan, Clinical Director of Substance Use Disorder Initiatives at Mountain Area Health Education Center, MAHEC in Asheville, North Carolina, and Dr. Cheryl Viracola, who's the Director of Practice Advancement for the NC Association of Pharmacists and leads various opioid initiatives with that organization. Our first question is meant to set the stage. What exactly is buprenorphine? Dr. Viracola, take it away.
Well, buprenorphine is one of three drugs that we commonly use to treat opiate use disorder. It's considered a partial opioid agonist, and its claim to fame is it binds very tightly to opioid receptors in the brain, which allows it to displace other opioids like heroin, opiates of abuse, if you will, from attaching to those same sites, ultimately blunting their effect or blocking their effect, that effect of the euphoria or the high that patients experience, but also those negative effects like respiratory depression. And it's this blockade that really helps to deter patients from returning to use while they're being maintained on buprenorphine. Because it's a partial agonist, it only partially activates the opioid receptor as well, which produces effects that are much less than what we see with full agonist opioids such as heroin. Again, that lowers its abuse potential. It also has a ceiling effect to euphoria and respiratory depression, meaning that even if the dose of the buprenorphine increases, then these effects remain the same. So they're not really increasing along with increasing doses. And again, that adds to its safety profile. All in all of these properties put together make it a really safe alternative to, say, other drugs we use, such as methadone.
Dr. Fagan?
I agree. In patients who have opiate use disorder, buprenorphine can make there be no withdrawal symptoms and can drive their cravings to zero or close to zero. And then the patient can, quote, do life without constantly thinking about how do I get my drug? How do I get my money to get my drug?
Yeah. What are the different formulations of buprenorphine and how can providers decide which of them or which is best for their patients?
Well, there's a variety of buprenorphine products on the market. Frankly, most are either manufacturer is either a mono product, which contains only buprenorphine, or they come in a combination product, which contains both buprenorphine and naloxone. They come in a variety of formulations as well, ranging from anything from a buccal film, which is meant to be dissolved between the cheek and gum, to sublingual films and sublingual tablets, which are dissolved underneath the tongue, and then, of course, extended-release injections and implants that can last anywhere from 1 to 6 months. The buccal films or sublingual films and tablets are really representative of the norm because buprenorphine has such poor absorption when it's actually administered orally. But generally speaking, its combo products are also the preferred agents over the mono products because they add that layer of protection against abuse when they contain the naloxone. Now, naloxone, if you remember, is an opioid antagonist, and it's used to reverse opioid overdose. But in doing so, it also precipitates withdrawal. So in theory, it's not well absorbed when it's given sublingually or buccally alongside buprenorphine. And the thought is that in doing so, if a patient's taking their product correctly, then they really shouldn't feel any effects of the naloxone whatsoever, although I have to say there might be some argument to that with some folks out there. But ultimately what it does is it, if a person tried to adulterate, or let's say they wanted to melt the films or the tablets for the purpose of injecting the medication, then the naloxone itself would be absorbed, precipitating this rather wicked withdrawal that we talk about most patients really never want to ever experience again.
Yeah, so most patients with opiate use disorder use the buprenorphine naloxone combination product. And just so you all hear, so you can tell your patients out there, what I say to patients is, hey, before using this film or tablet, which goes under the tongue, I want you to not smoke, eat, or drink acidic fluids like caffeine or containing products like coffee and sodas for 10 minutes beforehand. And then the mouth needs to be damp. So if your mouth is dry, put a little bit of water in it. And then you put the film or the tablet under the tongue for 5 to 10 minutes. And that's when you're going to absorb the medicine. After 10 minutes, you're not going to absorb any more of the medicine. You'll have this warm spit wad and you can spit it out. But know that most patients, particularly at the beginning, when they're first taking this medicine, they will swallow it. And sometimes they have no effects, which is fine. Sometimes they'll get some nausea or some headaches. And so when we hear about those side effects, we encourage them to spit it out. Like was said, almost no absorption of this medicine in the gut system. So it's really all absorbed right there under the tongue.
Dr. Fagan, what's the difference between the mono and combination buprenorphine products? We've heard that discussed a little bit. Can you put a point on that for us?
Yeah. So it is confusing to patients, by the way, and then it is confusing to providers, particularly at the beginning when they're first kind of getting some familiarity with this drug. So the combo product or combination product is the buprenorphine naloxone together. And in general, when I'm teaching about this medicine, I recommend that people start off using just the combo product with their patients. And what happens is the buprenorphine has naloxone in it. Like, let's just say a common dose would be 8 milligrams of buprenorphine and 2 milligrams of naloxone. And if taken correctly, which again is under the tongue, the naloxone has a negligible absorption. If taken incorrectly, which is like melted down into a spoon and then drawn up into a syringe and then injected into the vein, that's when the naloxone comes into play and the patient will be thrown into immediate full-blown withdrawal. What you hope is your patient will never use the product incorrectly. But if they do, the idea is that they will only do it once because being thrown into full-blown withdrawal feels terrible, and hopefully they won't do that again. And that's the whole point of having the naloxone in the combination product, is as a deterrent. So the mono product is just the buprenorphine with no naloxone in it.
Let's talk about diversion for a minute. Some providers have expressed concerns about potential diversion. What are the common reasons then behind diversion? What can providers and others do to reduce the likelihood of that happening?
Yeah, so diversion is a thing. We think that it's happening out there. I just want to acknowledge that. But we do have studies now that show that most buprenorphine is diverted to people who are family, friends, someone that has a use disorder, and they just don't want to go into withdrawal. They just don't want to have the craving so that they can do life that day, maybe get to work or whatever. And that's the data that's out there. People aren't diverting buprenorphine to family, friends, or what have you, so that someone can, quote, get high, end quote. And that, again, I just want to say is the data on what's out there. People are buying it from someone or taking it from a friend because they've run out, or they've realized, hey, my friend is doing well, I want to try that. And then, because I don't want to take fentanyl or use fentanyl anymore. And then they try it and they do better, or we hope they do, and then they'll actually seek care.
Dr. Vera Cole, do you have thoughts on diversion?
Yeah, I think I have to say I echo Dr. Fagan's sentiments. I think most people out there that are end up getting their buprenorphine off the street, they're really doing so because they're trying to wean themselves off of their opioids of abuse, if you will. And or they may live in areas where they really have no legal opportunities to seek treatment from licensed providers.
Put a point on this as well then. What about other formulations? Does the buprenorphine mono product have the same deterrent then?
Yeah, so it doesn't. If the buprenorphine mono product is the tablet that's out there, you'll hear some patients talk about Subutex. But just to be clear for those that are listening, Subutex is a brand name that's not on the market anymore. So what they really mean is the buprenorphine mono product without the naloxone in it. And if melted down in a spoon, drawn up, and then injected into the vein, they will get 100% of that buprenorphine within minutes. So they can get a high, or what they'll talk about as a bump from that, or a euphoria. So what you hope is that patients don't do that. Some patients, and it seems to be a very small percentage of them, will need the mono product for various reasons. But again, for those of you that are listening that are thinking about using the buprenorphine and getting more comfortable with it, we really recommend the combo product. And then if a patient really says, hey, I need the mono product, I want to say there are ways to do this. So one is you can refer them to a higher level of care. There's many of the OTPs, or opioid treatment programs, the new terminology for methadone clinics, that will prescribe buprenorphine. And if you think about it, if you're getting a daily dosing of the medicine, you don't need the deterrent in it because you watch the patient put it under their tongue and take the medicine right in front of you. So they can use the mono product at these opioid treatment programs. And then another way to get the mono product, again, if a patient says, hey, I really need the mono product for whatever reason, is there is an injected intramuscular form of buprenorphine, and it goes under the skin. It lasts for 30 days. I've had many patients do really well on this. And then think about it. If it's under the skin, you can't really like get it out. You can't like scoop it out with a spoon. So there's no reason to need the deterrent or the naloxone in there. So that is another way to get the mono product.
With buprenorphine working so well, why is it sometimes so difficult for patients to access this drug? I'll leave this to both of you. Dr. Varicola?
I think from a pharmacy's perspective, unfortunately, there's a lot of reasons. The one that rises to the top, and frankly, the one that I think is the most common misconception among pharmacists, is this belief that there's some ordering cap or limit on the amount of buprenorphine that a pharmacy can stock or order. Many pharmacists also go so far as to believe that this is something that's imposed by the Drug Enforcement Agency. And while it's true that the distribution of buprenorphine is federally regulated through the DEA, truth be told, there's nothing within the Controlled Substances Act nor the DEA regulations that set quantity limits on the amount of controlled substances that someone can order. Nor do they require that any DEA registrant, such as a wholesaler, set such limits. So this is something that we need to definitely identify and help to create awareness in the pharmacy profession. We're probably not the only ones out there that are a little confused over this either, because I know given just this year, back in January, the DEA actually issued published guidance around this very topic. So now what they do say, or what the DEA does require, is that to ensure a system of checks and balances, is that wholesalers have to monitor and report suspicious controlled substance ordering activity. But again, that's a pretty broad statement, and it really leaves the responsibility all on the wholesalers to figure out how they're going to carry that out. Some wholesalers end up developing their own monitoring systems to maintain compliance and to avoid their own scrutiny from the DEA. And then in creating these monitoring systems, they come up with these algorithms or these electronic rules that set these thresholds, i.e. sort of enter the quantity limit or the restrictions. And these restrictions decline a pharmacy's purchase order if it exceeds what they've ordered in the past. Unfortunately, that ends up creating a red flag, marking the order as suspicious, and then ultimately the wholesaler triggering a report to the DEA, whether the order was legitimate or not. Unfortunately, if the wholesaler refuses to fill the pharmacy's order, it sort of creates a trickle effect, leaves the pharmacist thinking that they've exceeded some sort of ordering allotment, again, that really doesn't exist. If pharmacists feel that ordering too much buprenorphine might trigger a DEA investigation or result in the loss of their DEA registration or their licensing, or perhaps harm their business, then of course they're going to choose not to rock the boat by arguing for more supply. And then on the flip side, even worse, they could choose not to provide buprenorphine at all within their pharmacy, so they don't even stock it. We've also had reports that even when pharmacists have tried to supplement and increase their orders by using other wholesalers, then once their primary wholesalers found out, then they have actually discontinued that pharmacy within their customer base. So again, really negative consequences that ensue from all of this. Other factors that I think pharmacists sort of raise a red flag, or scenarios in which create situations where they're a little bit reluctant to dispense buprenorphine, or when they encounter prescriptions or new patients that they haven't ever seen before. So perhaps a patient is living in an area and visiting the pharmacy outside their catchment area to get their buprenorphine filled, or perhaps the prescriber that's writing for the buprenorphine, their practice is in another location or outside their geographical area. Some pharmacists are overly concerned when the buprenorphine mono product is prescribed over the combination product. They also have concerns when the observed patients are too familiar with their product. You know, a lot of times patients are very familiar with their buprenorphine doses or their buprenorphine product. A lot of them can tell you exactly what it looks like. They can tell you what the imprint is on their tablet or their capsule, and they have valid reasons for that. But to a pharmacist, that may raise a red flag that perhaps there's some sort of diversion going on, that they have this, you know, insatiable appetite, if you will, for a particular product. And then they're also cautious, very much so, in cases where products or controlled substances or buprenorphine are being requested early. And while, you know, again, I have to say all of these sort of scenarios can rightfully raise a red flag to pharmacists where they might suspect drug misuse or potential diversion or abuse, these scenarios rarely align with the misuse or diversion of buprenorphine in the treatment setting of OUD. And I can't help stress that enough, is that this is not what we commonly see as a diversion pattern when it comes to buprenorphine.
Dr. Viracola, great answer. Dr. Fagan, do you have thoughts on this, why buprenorphine is sometimes difficult to access, difficult for patients to get their hands on?
Yeah, so I'd say two or three points I want to make is, one is there's not enough providers out there that are prescribing the medication. And I think more and more prescribers are coming down the pike. So they're teaching this in medical schools. So in North Carolina, all five of our medical schools are now teaching and getting people comfortable with the buprenorphine product. So as they go into residencies, they're going to have a familiarity and hopefully write this. So that's going to help us. The second thing I want to say is, now that the X waiver has gone away, we now have over a million people, providers that have a DEA license that now can write this product. And so we're hoping, and we're starting to see that more and more providers, because that barrier is gone, are writing buprenorphine. Even if their comfort is not great, they're writing for a short amount of time and then getting the patient to care that for their buprenorphine prescriptions long term. But the biggest reason I want to say that we're having difficulty here is because of stigma and bias. And it's not just the providers. I mean, some of us, and that includes me, I'm going to raise my hand on this one. Before 2011, if somebody would have said, hey, you need to write buprenorphine for people that have opiate use disorder, I would have said, there's no way I'm doing that. And then I had a patient of mine that died from an overdose, and it changed my life and my prescribing habits. But I think the stigma there for providers, but I also want to say the stigma and bias is there for patients and their loved ones. So I've seen over and over again where a patient gets on buprenorphine and their life starts to come back and stabilize for them. And immediately their loved ones are saying, you got to get off that medicine. Look, you don't need it anymore. And we know with chronic diseases, when you stop your medicine, the chronic disease gets worse. So there's a lot of educating and re-educating in the room that I do. And I think a lot of providers out there that are writing buprenorphine are needing to do that because of the stigma and bias around this drug in particular and around opiate use disorder.
Well, Dr. Fagan, you mentioned that more providers are now writing prescriptions for buprenorphine. Dr. Viracola, what can we do, or what can be done, to improve access then to the drug itself, so more people can prescribe it, but you still need the drug? What about access to the drug then?
Well, I think for one, we need clear regulatory guidance from the DEA, especially to our wholesalers. You know, again, they charge the wholesalers with detecting suspicious orders, but then they don't really provide a lot of guidance on what standards are regarding what constitutes this quote-unquote suspicion, and then even order suspension, if you will. I think we also need clear communication and collaboration between wholesalers and pharmacies, you know, so concerns regarding the appropriateness of buprenorphine orders can be easily resolved. If pharmacies need to increase their supply, they really need to feel comfortable calling or messaging the wholesaler with the rationale for why they want this increase. Furthermore, I think wholesalers need to accommodate those requests, especially when documentation clearly supports the need. We also need the same communication and collaboration rapport between opiate use providers or treatment providers and pharmacists. Neither profession should be apprehensive about communicating with the other when it comes to ensuring the continuity of care of our multiple patient or our mutual patients. Yet we often hear from both sides that they're reluctant to talk to each other for fear they might be interrupting each other's busy schedules. And I think everybody in healthcare, as we know, is really busy. So we've really got to get past that. Providers also, I think, can be very helpful to pharmacists in advocating for the need for more increased supplies by sharing the population of patients that they actually have on buprenorphine. If a pharmacist knows the number of patients that a provider's treating, what formula they're using, how often they're giving it, you know, they can really go a long way to helping them more accurately determine how much buprenorphine and what type of buprenorphine they're going to need. Again, being able to share what they know in working with the providers, sharing that information with the wholesalers can also go a long way to, you know, sort of providing that documentation that's needed to substantiate any increases to buprenorphine.
So talking about access to buprenorphine, that relationship then between providers and pharmacists, Dr. Fagan, thoughts?
Yeah, I can't emphasize enough what's been said here. So thanks, Cheryl. But building relationships with pharmacists, it is key to all this. And I want you to know, like, when I write my prescriptions, particularly for a new patient, I'm writing things in the comment section to the pharmacists, you know, like, hey, this is a new patient, or hey, I'm filling this one day early because they're going out of town. And then I'm saying, contact me if you have questions. And then the second thing I would say is that I know I'm busy. I know that other providers out there are really busy. But if a pharmacist who is also very busy tries to get a hold of us, we need to take that call. I found that their phone calls are 30 seconds or less. They're apprehensive about calling. They don't want to interrupt you, but they're trying to be safe with the patient. They're trying to do the right thing. So I take the call, I listen, I try to answer the question, and then I say, thank you for calling. And that goes a long way to building this relationship.
That's great. Let's talk about in the clinical setting. Give us a couple of easy evidence-based harm reduction strategies that clinicians can implement today to improve the health outcomes for people who use drugs.
Yeah, so I think one of the big ones that we can all do is co-prescribe naloxone. So if any patient that has an opiate use disorder, any patient that endorses to you that they inject drugs and they're like, hey, I don't use fentanyl. Let's say they say my only drug that I use is methamphetamine. Well, because they don't know what's in the supply, they need naloxone. And so I'm really going to encourage you that any patient that you have that injects drugs needs to have naloxone. In North Carolina, since 2016, any patient can go into any pharmacy and pick up naloxone without a prescription. If you do have insurance, they run it through your insurance, so it'll be less expensive. If they have Medicaid, North Carolina Medicaid, it's $4. There's also ways to get naloxone from syringe access programs, so encouraging people to do that. The second thing is counseling all of our patients around safe opioid disposal. So talking to patients, if they get opioids, to get them out of their house. When they're in their house, lock them up. And this is a great prevention strategy for teens, their kids' friends, your grandkids, so that they don't get a hold of the opioids. So lock them up, and then if you don't use them, get them out of your house. The third is, I'd say, prescribe buprenorphine. It's a life-saving medication, and we should get comfort with prescribing it, even if it's just for a short amount of time, like I've said before, 3 or 5 days, and then directing that patient to a caregiver who can write that medicine long-term. And then finally, know your syringe access programs, and if patients are injecting drugs, make sure they know where they are and that they can get to them. Clean needles have been shown not only to reduce infections like HIV and hepatitis C, endocarditis, but parenthetically just saying, if you have to get a valve replacement from having severe endocarditis, it's a minimum of $200,000 to $300,000 procedure, or they can get on a life-saving medication like buprenorphine, and you can prevent that. So lots of great reasons to get folks to syringe access programs from an infectious disease side. But I also want to say, very good data that says once a patient who injects drugs is connected to a syringe access program, getting their syringes, the clean syringes that they need, then when they're ready to enter into care, they feel comfort with asking folks that they see at that syringe access, hey, how can I get help? And then they can immediately connect them to care.
Dr. Fagan, thank you so much. Dr. Viracola, I saw you nodding along there. Do you want to weigh in on that and maybe offer a few of your own evidence-based harm reduction strategies in a pharmaceutical setting that can improve the health outcomes for folks using drugs?
Yeah, certainly. I think one of the things that resonates most with me is that, you know, what I would like to see is that pharmacists that may not have a comfort level with working in the opiate space, first and foremost, they need to get educated. I think that starts with understanding the magnitude of the opiate crisis in our state and how it affects our citizens. But I also think they need to explore and look for those educational opportunities, ones that can help them to expand their professional growth and development in building opioid stewardship. I think we also need to see pharmacists getting more involved, becoming community partners, taking action, utilizing what they've learned to develop harm reduction strategies that can help us to connect patients to care and, you know, promote treatment for opiate use disorder, regardless of where they are in their journey, whether they're experiencing mild or moderate or even severe forms of opiate use disorder. I also think that, you know, we have an increasing number of pharmacies out there that are doing and have incorporated harm reduction services into their workflow models. And I would encourage pharmacists to think about ways in which they can start those similar practices within their store. For instance, we have several pharmacies out there that are currently providing naloxone services. They've incorporated them into their daily workflow. The patients that present to their pharmacy with a prescription for opioids, they're utilizing the CSRS. They're also using other validated screening tools like the opiate risk tool, the RIA sword, things of that nature to help determine a patient's risk for overdose. If they do see patients that exceed those validated screening thresholds where they are at risk, then they're taking the time and the effort to counsel those patients on the benefits of carrying naloxone and how it specifically relates to protecting them based off their specific circumstances. We're also seeing a growing number of pharmacies out there working collaboratively with syringe service programs in their local area. This is really new and innovative. I think one of the things that what we find is that a lot of times with syringe service programs, they operate on reduced hours. They may not be open every day a week. They may not be a brick and mortar facility. They may be a mobile or unit that goes out to certain areas. And when pharmacies are working collaboratively with them, they can act as an extension of that syringe service program. Pharmacies are open, you know, 7 days a week, you know, 12 hours a day. So it really increases access to some of the very same services that syringe service programs offer, including safe syringe supplies and use materials, as well as, you know, linking patients to care for either HIV or Hep C, and then ultimately to treatment for opiate use disorder when they are ready to explore that option.
Yeah, it's clear listening to both of you how collaboration is part of the solution here. Despite, though, buprenorphine and other medications for opioid use disorder being proven and evidence-based, there is still, or certainly could be, the misconception that prescribing buprenorphine is time-consuming and burdensome. What would you say to prescribers and dispensers still reluctant to be a resource for their community members that are struggling with an OUD? Folks still reluctant. Dr. Fagan?
Yeah, prescribing buprenorphine can be very rewarding. yes, sometimes patients that have a chronic disease return to use or do some backsliding, however you want to look at that, and that will take a little bit longer. But I can't tell you the number of patients that I've seen that were really struggling with this disease, and they get on the medication, and then they are seeing me like my diabetic patients or my high blood pressure patients. Their labs, like their urine drug screen, are as expected, and the visits can be very quick, and we can get the patients on to the rest of their day. Sometimes, though, it does take a little bit longer. I'm not going to say that doesn't happen at times, but this can be a very rewarding treatment. And now that I want to emphasize again, the X waiver is gone, we all have this ability to treat patients. And if you believe the literature from France, when they got rid of a similar X waiver in that country, their overdose death rates plummeted. Actually, the data was by 79% the year after that. So we're hoping that as more and more prescribers realize, hey, I don't have to have an X waiver, I can write this medicine, it's safe, my patients are not going to overdose and die on this medicine, and I can always just give a few days worth and get them to the treatment they need, that we're going to see similar rates here in this country.
Dr. Viracola, do you have similar thoughts? I saw you nodding there.
Well, I just have to say, I think this is a fantastic question. And I also want to say that it is so refreshing to hear Dr. Fagan speak to his experience in working with this patient population. I come from sort of a different area. I don't actually treat patients with opiate use disorder, but I'm definitely an advocate for patients that are suffering from this chronic and relapsing disease. And I'm very passionate about the fact that I think pharmacists can play a role in helping to decrease the opiate crisis in our state. So what I would leave you with is that, for me, if you look at data from the National Center for Health Statistics, 2021 was actually the deadliest year on record in this country for drug overdoses. We had over 107,000 individuals dying from a drug overdose. If you extrapolate that to North Carolina, over the last 10 years, North Carolina reports show that the death rate due to drug overdose has increased almost 223%. When you sort of look at that from a daily perspective, what that means now is that we have up to 11 individuals dying every day in this state, right here in our own backyard, from a drug overdose. For me, I started working in the opioid space back in 2010, and I can tell you that when I started working, that number was 3. So when I think about it, and I think about how we have, how we treat opiate use disorder, what's happening, and the fact that we still have this increase and this rise in overdose deaths, I think the time has come for us to seek change. We need to find more innovative solutions to expanding treatment access for our patients, right here in our own backyard. And to do so, we've talked a little bit about what some of those, collaborations might bring to the table in helping to do that. So from my perspective, I would just say for the physicians out there, no matter what your barriers are, thinking about if you're someone that wants to get involved and be more upfront with treating patients with opiate use disorder, that's great. But think about what kind of wraparound support and services you might be able to pull into your practice that could help you to treat patients. Frankly, if you have the wraparound support, perhaps you can treat more patients than you might originally think. So, and for that, we know that there's some evidence out there to support the pharmacist-physician collaboration. So look to that. Find out what's out there. Find out what pharmacists are doing with physicians in treating patients. And then, if you're so inclined, look to, exploring what pharmacists in your area might be able to help with that. Can you hire someone? Can you embed a pharmacist into your practice? And if you can't, call us. We'll help you connect with someone. call the association. We'll help you find a pharmacist that's experienced and trained in opiate use disorder and can help you with those matters.
Foundational information from both. Thank you so much, Dr. Cheryl Viracola, Director of Practice Advancement for the North Carolina Association of Pharmacists, Dr. Blake Fagan, Clinical Director of Substance Use Disorder Initiatives at the Mountain Area Health Education Center, MAHEC, in Asheville, North Carolina. Thank you to you both. What a great conversation today. If you've enjoyed today's conversation, head over to the Governor's Institute's YouTube page for more. That's youtube.com/govinst, G-O-V-I-N-S-T. Thanks for listening.